Career reel two.
All right.
So Martel was another
Martel,
character.
Yes, he was a sapper now, and he was he was an organizer, and he dreamt of the future very much, and thought a lot about it, and I lost sight of him during the later stages of the First War, but came across him when I was in the tank testing section in 1925, when he'd produced, out of his own pocket, a one-man tank, believing that a large number of small tanks might be better than a small number of big ones. But there were other competitors in the field on that, of course, as well.
What was your next appointment after you left the F Battalion?
I became an instructor at the Tank Engineer Officers School at Erin. And our functions there were to teach newly joined engineer officers in our methods of maintenance and salvage on the other problems connected with tank repair. And we also, in that time, as new machines appeared, we also also undertook to prepare written information about maintenance operations. In other words, we wrote maintenance handbooks to so that a crew could thumb the page and see how many nuts you took off to do this, the other, that, or the other thing.
Was this the first engineer officers' school of its kind in the Corps?
In France, yes, it was. Oh, yes, it was. I did one. I did a course there, a fortnight's course there, and went back to F Battalion. In a fortnight's time, I'd been hauled back as an instructor.
I see. What had been, what were the main lessons that had been learned, which it was possible for you to communicate to new engineer officers who were joining the Corps?
Well, I think the lessons that they had to be learned was be sure that your diagnosis of a fault is correct, and then decide on the best method of rectifying that fault with the minimum amount of labor. And we achieved that really with the standard methods of maintenance which we got out as time went on.
What kind of facilities did you have at Erin for training?
Oh, we had samples of tanks which we could take to pieces and put together again, and we had the usual things, special heavy tools for salvage, such as trestles for jacking tanks up, cranes you could stick on the front of a tank to lift an engine out, and that kind of thing. We did ourselves as part of the ordinary maintenance in units. We did no structural repairs. If a hull, for instance, were damaged by shell fire or by some other failure, the tank itself was then sent complete to Erin, to the workshops to be overhauled and put straight.
What was the proportion between theory and practice at Erin?
Well, the theoretical knowledge was small, because theoretical teaching was small, because men came to us as engineers and were expected to know the first principles of mechanics. But the practical handling of tanks, as they were sort of special kind of machine, was very much in evidence.
Did you, in the course of the training, simulate any of the sort of typical problems these trainees would have to deal with in due course?
Well, I suppose, yes, one did, because they asked questions. They sort of said, well, what do I do, supposing something happens to such and such a component? We'd either say, well, you can change that in situ, or you must whip out the complete assembly to which it's attached.
I was thinking of things like, for example, if you were teaching them about salvage operations, whether you would actually have facilities for them to do a sort of simulated salvage.
Yes, we had rough country, and they'd find a tank on its side, and they'd have to learn to right it and get it working again. We had, you know, various examples of things that happened to tanks.
Of course, the school was set up during the war, and probably like everything else, in a bit of a hurry. Did it have, of necessity, to be a bit rough and ready, or was it fairly well, courses fairly well structured and formalised?
I think we were fairly well equipped. We had sectioned engines and other bits and pieces set up so that people could examine them and see what they looked like inside. No, I wouldn't. I think we were well, all things considered, I think we were very well equipped for the job we had to do.
Well, this brings us up to the end of 1918. What was your next appointment after Erin?
In France, or at the end of 1918, I went up to the Rhine Army and became an instructor in the driving and maintenance school there. It had been set up to support the tank units which were then sent to Germany.
Where was the unit based?
The unit was based at a place called Lammersdorf, in the Eifel district of Germany, near a town called München, or Monschau, as it's sometimes known.
Yes. What was the setup, the scale of the establishment at Lammersdorf?
At Lammersdorf we had a commandant, an adjutant, a second in command, and there were six instructor officers, a quartermaster, and the supporting contingent of other ranks. And we employed some civilian German labour to keep the paths clear and all that kind of thing.
And what were the size of the courses you were running?
We used to run a course of six officers at a time. That means every instructor had six officers under him, which he could just about handle. And he had one tank and the other sort of strip facilities. But we found you could handle about six at a time and keep them busy and interested.
I see. Does that mean with six instructors each having six?
Yes.
So you had 36 going through
the
school?
Yes, we could handle 36 at a time.
Mm-hmm. The courses there, were there prescribed courses on driving and maintenance?
Yes, I was not on the driving side myself. I was on the maintenance side. And our course lasted about a fortnight, and during which time a student would succeed in taking out and replacing all the major units in the tank.
Now, at this stage, you were teaching ordinary tank officers, as opposed to engineering officers, as you had been at Erin. Did you have to sort of adapt your material to a different kind of animal?
Well, yes, it's necessary to change one's language, you know, and also perhaps approach a problem in a rather different way. But the officer of that era was keen. He was anxious to be in the Rhine Army, and he made the best of it.
I'm interested in the degree of maintenance skill which was expected of the standard tank corps officer at this time.
Yes.
Could you make that clear to me by perhaps describing the extent and content of the course?
Well, an officer would come on the course, he would have had regimental experience with the mark of tank, which he was to learn about. And then he may or may not have had some experience of maintenance. In the field, and if not, we then take him through the whole gamut of the thing, how to adjust brakes, how to make sure that the engine clutch is working properly, such things like oil and water circuits and all that kind of thing, and the whys and the wherefores of the arrangement of it, and then he got on to changing the units in the tank, to change an engine, change a gearbox, change the reduction gears and all the internals of the machine.
What kind of duties were tanks actually being used for in Germany in this post-war period?
Policing. There was a battalion in Cologne. Was situated in the barrack there, but as far as I can recollect, the mileage run wasn't high.
So it was internal security?
Yes, internal security.
Were exclusively light tanks used?
No, they were only Mark V's, the old heavy Mark V. That was the only tank that was taken up to Germany. The Whippets weren't taken up there. Because there weren't enough left at the end of the war.
As a layman, I would have thought the Mark V was about the worst possible kind of machine for an internal security function.
Well, it was a great big heavy brute. It handled very well on a road. But there wasn't anything else. See, we hadn't. The armoured car battalion didn't go up there, and I think that's all there was, because none of the machines after Mark V were sent to France at the conclusion of the war.
Did you get any information, perhaps from the people who were on your courses, about how effective these big heavy tanks were in internal security work?
No, I don't think I ever asked the question. I don't think so. But I don't think, as a matter of fact, I don't think there was ever an occasion on which tanks were called out in Germany. I can't remember one.
Now, you came back to England at the end of 1919, and you were posted to the Workshop Training Battalion at Bovington.
Yes.
What was Bovington like at that very early period in its history?
What was that like?
What was Bovington like at that early
period?
Well,
Bovington, you see, was formed early in 1917. It had the school, the central schools, and the depot. It was in these old-fashioned wooden huts. There were some permanent buildings. There were some of the workshop buildings were bricks and mortar. But it's, I saw Bovington, let me see, 1968, that was the last time I saw it. And really, the country, open country, hadn't changed very much over the years. And
mm-hmm.
some of the buildings, which I remember, were still being used for the same purpose. There were extensions, of course, such as the museum and those other things like that. And I believe they built a new mess, but I didn't see it.
Yes. The tank corps at this time was still being run by officers who'd been seconded to it to a great extent.
Yes.
What was the sort of spirit in the Corps in the immediate post-war period?
You see, when the tank Corps was established on a peacetime footing, there were not sufficient a large number of wartime tank officers to fill the more senior ranks, and there was a drafting in a lot of senior people. It made a lot of the lower ranks, the subalterns and junior captains and such like. It set them back a bit, but the thing had to happen.
But why did it set them back a bit?
Well, it set back promotion.
Oh, I see. Yes.
Whereas, for instance, if a fellow who was like subaltern on the fighting side with me had come back to England and been promoted in the ordinary course of events, he'd almost certainly gone straight up to major. Mm-hmm. But of course, that didn't happen that way. They brought people in, and of course they brought in some very good men. We the corps profited greatly by that.
You found, did you, that the quality of the senior officers who had been brought in the post-war period fairly high?
Oh yes. Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Who were the personalities at Bovington when you first went there?
Well, now Stack. Do you mean after the war? After the war, yes. Well, there was a fellow called Bill Stack who commanded the workshop training battalion. He was a hard case. He'd been in France. But he was one of the leading engineers in France, and he took his job very seriously, but he later on transferred to the Royal Army Ordnance Corps, and we had a man called Hudson come, a gunner, and took charge of the workshop training battalion. Well, he was a very competent man. In fact, I served under him in various positions, military and civil, until he retired. Then, of course, there was Major General Ellis. Now, I think Fuller had gone to the War Office by then. So had Martell. I can't call to mind. Oh, another man at Bovington, Tim Pyle, commanded the 3rd Battalion. He was a gunner who later commanded the aircraft defences of London in this last war. They were the sort of men I really remember.
Did Ellis make his personality felt very much at your relatively humble level?
Well, Ellis was a down-to-earth man, but I think he must have retired some short time after I went up to Farnborough.
Mm-hmm. Now, what was the scale and the purpose of the workshop training battalion when you joined it?
Well, the scale of the workshop training battalion was to train engineer officers and the people who ultimately would have become the staff sergeants. You see, the establishment was roughly one engineer officer and a staff sergeant per tank company. And all these youngsters, we had a boys' company, and there were, I forget how many other companies there were, but in addition to the actual training, we had this job, of course, of fitting out the peacetime battalions.
Tell me what was involved in that, in as much detail as you can remember.
When the war ended, a number of tanks of different marks were being manufactured at various places, and as they were completed, they were sent to Bovington, there to be parked on down land for either further use or disposal. Now, the functions
a part of the function of the workshop training battalion was to select from this dump tanks to equip the peacetime battalions. There were two marks chosen. There was a Mark V, which had already been in use in the war, and the medium Mark C, which had never seen action, but was about an 8-mile-an-hour machine, and was a very suitable replacement for the Whippet. And we picked suitable examples out of the heap, reconditioned them, and then they were issued to battalions.
What kind of criteria did you use in selecting from the host of equipment available the ones to issue?
Well, first of all, since this host of vehicles included machines that had seen service, and the Mark V's which had seen service, we went by and large to pick out new machines, particularly with certain makes of engine, which we knew to be very reliable, you see. And we got them in, got them running, and properly adjusted, and then issued them.
But this was a process of selection and rejection, so
oh,
you
yes.
must have been...
Yes, it was.
What grounds would you reject some and select others?
Well, you'd say this one, you'd look at a tank and you'd say, well, this one's been a runner. The tracks are badly worn, and you could tell from position the condition of brakes, for instance. You'd say, well, this means putting a new set of brake liners in and things that kind. And then we decide, well, it's not worth doing. We'll have a look at another one. We might come across a machine which had done no running at all and merely wanted turning over and getting to work.
Did most of them require some attention from you?
Oh, yes. Yes, we used to... I had my men divided into crews of four, and the four men would manage to turn out about one tank a week.
I see.
After they brought it into the shops.
You mentioned when we spoke earlier something which interested me very greatly, the experimental work with the medium Mark D. I'd be very interested to hear as much detail as you can tell me about that episode.
The search for speed had already commenced before the end of the First War. As an example, we had in France, we secured a Rolls-Royce Falcon aircraft engine, which we installed in the Mark V tank hull and put the speed up to approaching 12 miles an hour, which was a fair achievement in those days. But in the meantime, the search for speed was on in England as well, only this time with a specially designed machine sprung by what was then known as cable suspension. The road roller, the road wheels, were sprung against a steel cable. It's rather complicated to describe, but in any case, it offered some springing, and an Armstrong Siddeley 250 horsepower Puma engine was installed, and with a weight of 18 tons, the machine with its epicyclic transmission and hydraulic control would do about 30 miles an hour on good country. But the track was very unreliable and frequently used to come off with rather disastrous results. So although that design appeared in another variant, this time with a Rolls-Royce Eagle engine, it was not perpetuated. And we then, by that time, Farnborough had been established and other machines began to come along.
I take it that your discovery that the tracks were unreliable, you found out through some kind of field test you put them
oh,
through.
Oh, yes. Yes. Yes, it's in. With experience, one, first of all, you suspect from looking at the design that this is not going to be a very good track to stop, to stop on, as we say. And then you probably find that when you apply your usual fancy tests, that it either does or doesn't.
What sort of test did you apply?
Oh, skid turns on rough country.
That was about as tough as you could make it, was
yes.
it?
Yes, and skid turns on rough country.
And what happened?
Oh, the track had simply come off the rollers, and then you find yourself with the tank sitting on its rollers and the track lying in the track alongside. Then you proceed to jack it all up and tuck it all back into position again.
It must have been a perverse kind of way, been slightly attractive to actually be sanctioned to ruin an entirely new and experimental and highly advanced machine.
Well, I sometimes think that some of the designers of those machines would have done better had they fought in a tank and seen what it was actually like before they put pen to paper.
Mm.
But, of course, if we may continue from the medium D type of machine, of which only some, I think about six were built, in varying variations of it. We really started our post-First War tank with the advent of the Vickers light tank, a 12-tonner with a properly sprung suspension, which lasted in some shape or form until this last war started.
Yes. Going back to the medium Mark D,
yes.
In your trials, did you identify any other weaknesses or defects other than the tracks?
Yes. The hydraulic control system was very tricky. It needed a bit of pilotage to get the best out of the machine.
Anything else?
Well, of course, it had no revolving turrets, you see. It would have had a gun firing forward with limited traverse. But there was not to my knowledge, was a medium D ever armed for firing trials.
What was the drill after you had done your tests? Did you have to submit reports?
Oh, yes. I wrote a daily report. At Farnborough, a machine did its daily run, and a report was written on mileage, fuel consumption, defects en route, and all that kind of thing, and work to be done at the conclusion of the run before the next time out.